Those of you who are in Kalpas, having it to CN, listen to, do remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning. I usually come for Children's Day, I guess. It's just coincidence, so I'm always nervous about it because, you know, children are so unpredictable. And here you are. And there's so far no unpredictability going on. Keep trying. So while I was at Tassajara last month teaching a class, I went twice. In June there was an evening there, a discussion of how badly people felt, the students at Tassajara felt, about doing Zazen at Tassajara while the world is going to hell in a handbasket fast. And there was much agony expressed about this, much concern, and a lot of despair. And because this was a group of mixed generations, people in their 20s, all the way up to my generation, people in their 60s, and there were people of my generation who had been socially active there was some comparison between the feeling of social activism in the 60s and now. And the broad general strokes that were drawn at that time was that in my generation, things seemed very hopeful and joyous and playful. And now, young people feel despair and bitterness. Those were the broad strokes that were drawn. And the things are much, much worse globally than they were then, which of course is true. So this conversation intrigued me very much. Maybe it was the big event of my summer. I was quite touched by what people said. First of all, I like to listen to young people talk. I'm very aware that my own worldview is obsolete and has limited usefulness as instruction for young people. My son has been hammering this into my head for many years. And the way I think the world works on a cultural level, it no longer does. I accept that. So I like to hear what supplanted my paradigm. What cultural realities have arisen on top of mine in this continuing dialectic? So I can guess what the new paradigm is by watching commercials on TV or listening to young people. Either one will give you a great deal of information about what the value system is currently in our culture. But my preference is to listen to young people. So, secondly, I was very politically active in the 60s myself. I quit my job, which was funded by an NIMH grant, the National Institute of Mental Health grant, to study schizophrenic children with a protege of B.F. Skinner in Cambridge. It was D.F. Skinner who got me my library card to Harvard. And I enjoyed this milieu tremendously. Cambridge was a very small town, and if you knew somebody like D.F. Skinner, then you knew Robert Kennedy and the various poets and women in their 40s that I just couldn't wait to have as my mentors. It was a very exciting time for me. And I eventually quit that job, though, because I thought it was immoral to work for the government. So that, this was during the early stages of the Vietnam War. So my quitting because I thought it was immoral to work on an NIMH grant shows you how unprepared I was for the world. So after I quit, I did draft counseling and anti-war work until my emotional stability was compromised by some of the events that I witnessed during that time. Events which made it impossible to continue holding the simplistic idealistic view that I had of humankind. And I got to see how human beings really behave when they're frightened or threatened. And I think what's different now, currently, is not the basic aspects of greed, hate, and delusion. That just chugs along since time began. It's that the determination and rapaciousness with which the world is being raped and exploited has become so much more efficient and so self-confident that no force can stand in its way. At least it looks that way. And government officials bothered to lie to my generation. I mean, now, they don't even bother. What can we do? Well, I'll tell you what we can do. Until the numbers tilt our way, like with the Vietnam War, and it may be some years, we can work much harder at presenting to everyone that we come in contact with a heart-based initiative as an alternative to the materialism and fundamental religiosity that is sweeping the globe. Another way must be modeled. A way for all people, regardless of the usual differences between people, to flourish and care for each other. Everyone must be able to do this. And this way must be based in Zazen, or some other similar activity which grounds rage and makes despair creative and opens the heart. I know that Zazen is not the only discipline or the only practice on earth that both grounds us and opens us at the same time, but it's the only one that I personally know of. And so I'd like to sing its praises to you today as a basis for social action. So I assume that this lecture ends at 10:45, something like that, 11? Okay. So for the next half hour, I'd like to present my point of view and how practice has formed it. First of all, everything I've ever learned of value I've learned from being in unbearable states of body and mind. And then, this is a venerable way of studying and learning. The unbearable is seen as a deeply reliable, true teacher. Maybe this is why Zen has such a reputation in the United States as a tough path. How we got to be the Catholics of Buddhism, I don't know. But it's in this realm. We don't practice to feel good about ourselves. We don't practice to improve ourselves, to become better people. We practice to find a source of energy and wisdom beyond the self. And we're content to leave the self to do what the self does best. You know, manage the affairs of this person and the maintenance of this flesh. We're content to let the self do that while we find a home in something vaster, wider, and more immediate. You won't really find this home, though, until you have no choice. And that's why the unbearable is such an honored teacher in Zen. So in 1969, my social activism came to an end. During the years I spent in the anti-war movement, I saw things I will never get over, as I intimated. I can start crying immediately whenever I'm on this topic. It's always available to me, the grief that I felt then. It's never healed, and it probably never will. I saw people shot. I saw friends doing the shooting. I saw the beating and murders of humans and animals. And finally, I had to quit. I said to myself, I don't have the emotional stability to do this work. And I was right. I was so right. More than I knew at the time, actually. When I look back, I was so right. But what I didn't know is that almost no one does. And I was right that that's what this takes, this kind of work takes, is emotional stability, enormous emotional stability. The unstable ones become depressed, bitter, outraged to the point of homicide, and enervated. They lose their energy. So at the time, it was unthinkable to go back to the academic professional world from which I had come after all this, after years in the anti-war movement. So I became a hippie by default. And actually, I wasn't temperamentally suited to be a hippie. I'm way too energetic, and I don't do very well with unstructured time. My energy tends to leak away if it just has an endless, open-ended container. But I was depressed and aimless, so I did my best to be a hippie. But besides the sex and drugs, it was a complete waste of time. I sat my first sesshin in 1970. December 1970, because my Grateful Dead roadie boyfriend, Tony Patchell, brought me to it. And it completely changed my life. Well, my life was unbearable. It was open for change. But it was odd that this sesshin, I hadn't sat before, it was my first sitting experience. It was odd that that sesshin would change it. Because it was unbearable. But I made the connection between it being unbearable and my life being unbearable. And I saw the sesshin as just an incredibly condensed and dramatic version of my life. I tried to simply sit still with unbearable physical pain and mental restlessness. And what I had to do merely to continue to stay in the Zendo was give up every thought I had that led me away from right here. It was so dangerous to do anything but right here. If my mind just wandered a tiny bit to a moment when I might find relief in the future, like when the bell rang, or if I would sit down after Kinghin for a new period and say, this time I will sit still, in other words, some future, making a commitment to the future. If I did anything like that, allowed even a split second of that kind of activity, I was immediately cast into the hell realm, reserved for people who sneak into the future looking for something better, or who distance themselves from the misery of the moment by trying to become a better person. So no matter how painful or boring or unbearable or annoying your situation is right now, it's always better than some dream, some ghost life that you can't embody as Wu Men put it, clinging to bushes and grasses for some kind of desperate solidity that you yourself can't feel. So you might quite reasonably ask, in what way is it better? It's not an unreasonable decision to make, that of distracting yourself indefinitely from some unbearable realization of pain. It's understandable that we don't want to expose ourselves to terrible suffering. That in order to make this decision intelligently, you must know that there's a high price to be paid for turning away from your suffering. And it's completely up to you whether you want to pay it. That is, one karmic consequence of turning away is that it increases the odds that you'll always turn away. Your staying with muscle gets weaker and shyer. And it doesn't mean that you can't at some point, if the crisis is big enough, just break through and settle where you never have before. You can always do that. But it gets harder. So if you scratch an itch or wipe your runny nose during zazen, it's actually harder to face a cancer diagnosis or devastation from divorce. And somewhere in your being, you are registering yours and other people's suffering, regardless of what your conscious mind decides to do. And in order to distract yourself successfully, you have to turn away again and again from the part of yourself that registers the suffering. If you deny your pain or suffering for a long time, you begin to exist on a bleak tundra of non-feeling. The highs are flatter. The lows are duller. But amazingly enough to me, this is always amazes me when students say to me that that's what they're after. This damping of feeling is why some people practice. They call it equanimity. But nothing could be further from equanimity. True equanimity is having the full feeling, allowing the full feeling, but not preferring to not have it. That's equanimity. A very different thing. And a much more interesting way to live, by the way. A willingness to have your heart broken again and again. And not trying not to have it broken. You knew this was part of the deal. Attachment brings suffering. It doesn't mean don't be attached. Just know when you get attached, this is the consequence. Helping others brings heartbreak. That's the deal. Tremendous emotional stability. That's what it takes. So let's say that you're clear that you want to live to the fullest, to experience all that a human being is capable of, sublime inspiration and joy, anguish and grief, outrage at injustice. You wouldn't choose to dampen anything that comes up. You just want to be effective in your work and reasonably happy in your everyday life. So this is doing suffering, if not gladly, then doing it because it's there under your nose. Maybe the bottom line is that observing your suffering while you're doing it holds the key to your liberation. This is why mindfulness of suffering is so important to every school of Buddhist practice. Mindfulness of suffering. This is why it's the first noble truth. Not necessarily because it's making a statement about what Buddha considered reality, but it's definitely the entering place, the gate for practice. So you can't make any space in your suffering. You can't learn how to do that if you don't suffer. You have to be there to see the elements that make up your particular suffering in order to shift them in any way. You may choose not to shift them. But in that case, if you don't shift the elements, you just use them to ground yourself, to develop more stability, it still has a very different impact on you because you see the origin of the suffering. It grounds you deeply in the body. So this body realm, I've been talking about this a lot lately, and I don't mind talking about it more. This body realm is one of infinite texture and subtlety, because the body is in touch with just this. And if you are still enough to be here in just this, then you see the texture, the infinite and intricate detail of everyone and everything that's in any room that you enter, especially a room like this with so many feelings and so many breaths, so many abs. It's quite overwhelming to feel this, but then you're also calm. So it can be taken in. So this texture, coming into this world of infinite variety and detail, and feeling it as support, this is very important if you need emotional stability, and who doesn't, or if you're in pain, to see the suchness of things as support, as benign. And then this is very much the basis of the teacher-student relationship. I think what's actually happening when people spend time together and they have some sort of mutual interest is in the body. This is a tremendous teaching, to spend time in the physical presence of your teacher, or as a teacher, in the physical presence of your student. Every gesture, every movement of the body around each other takes on meaning. It's charged. It's just here. No one else exists in the world except you and your teacher, you and your student. And everything is dynamic and is a container for the relationship. A student and I, actually a student I'm not particularly close with, in Burlingame, in the Crystal Spring Sangha, one of the sanghas that I sit with, we set a sesshin together, this fellow and I, 5 days. Our sangha went down to Vajrapani, a retreat center in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and we were a small group, about 25, and we got very close during that 5 days for various reasons, which I won't go into. But when we came back, we met on Thursday night, the following Thursday night, our usual sangha night at Mercy Center in Burlingame, and this fellow was the Doan. You know, we take a month turn, everybody. And he was new to being a Doan. And I had just given a new instruction to the head of Doans that the Doan should indicate to me when it was time to go up and offer incense to the altar to begin the Vajra. That was a new instruction. And as I sat there across from my Doan, this fellow, I realized that I hadn't specified what signal that it was, and I didn't know whether this new Doan had been given the instruction. So I decided to give it a long time. I didn't have a watch, so I didn't know when to start, but I thought, well, I'll give it a very long time, and then I'll just go up and light the incense. He doesn't give me any clue. So I began sitting, and my eyes were, you know, a few feet in front of me, maybe a few yards, and they were kind of impinging on his body, on his leg. And we were sitting there, and then, just then, I looked up into his face, and he blinked twice. I was thrilled. It had come to this. That subtle. He blinked twice, and I went up and off his head. This is tremendously satisfying. So this kind of intimacy and respect for the richness of our existence, I think that it's a good realm for social action to arise from. Because this kind of intimacy engenders, or the still mind, that's what I want to say, the still mind that perceives this and initiates this kind of intimacy. And what is the basic thing that the still mind perceives in order to do something like he did, and for me to catch it at just the right time? It understands how embedded we are in this constantly changing, dynamic world. The still mind gets. And because of that intimacy with everything, the respect that we have for others, and the appreciation of the relativity of our own opinion, is an excellent start, an excellent basis for social action. I think that this allows us to have tons of energy to work with, energy that's not depleted by deceit, clarity, self-awareness, and great ground. So who is helping create this world that I'm describing? This alternative to materialism and fundamentalism. Who's doing this? I think certainly people who are very familiar with the causes of the problem, greed, hate, and delusion, and awareness of the presence of them in their own hearts. So that's a good start, to know what you're capable of. That way you don't project out onto other people, you know, your nasty, irritable, closed side. You own it. This is very helpful in any kind of relationship, to own your own dark side. A person whose commitment inspires others without polarizing. He or she doesn't write off any individual or group of people despite their point of view. Now, this is easy to say and hard to do. Can you just stand with a person? They're the only person in the world because you're just there with them. Nobody around you. And, oh no, they have the opposite political views and they're the only person in the world. Can you be there? Can you be there? They're breathing like you are. They're fearful like you are. They're trusting like you are. Can you be there in that? People who have the ability to create and sustain a samadhi of the four bodhisattva vows. And you know what they are. Vowing to save all beings, which I'm currently, I interpret that different ways over my life. Right now, it's connecting with other beings, is how I'm seeing saving. Delusions, recognizing delusions. Entering Dharma Gate, the third bodhisattva vow, and following Buddha's way, embodying Buddha's way. So how do you create and sustain a samadhi of this so that your powers of grounding and concentration get deeper and deeper as you practice these? What this means is being able to become more and more focused and concentrated on the problem and the solutions in every action. What's the problem in this? You're going to the kitchen to make a meal. You know, where did your food come from? Every decision, every spoken word, a person who can create and sustain a samadhi of the four bodhisattva vows is able to find all satisfactions, all defeats, all challenges, and all connections in the subtleties, the microcosmic spaces of perception. Everything you do, peeing, making your dinner, talking to people, getting on the bus, all the decisions you make about how you live, they're part of the samadhi and they deepen. And part of the samadhi is awareness of your own energy level. This is so important, this awareness of your energy level. Even if you have tons of energy and don't have to worry about how it's being spent, even if you have enough energy to spare, imagine the intensification of plowing it back into some concentrated state of mind. This kind of practice enables us to step up again and again to the back. To sustain our samadhi, despite criticism, to keep working, to keep modeling our belief system, even when there's no payoff for it, no payoff that we can see. No payoff locally or globally, as far as we can see. And you know, when you look for a result of your own social endeavors, that's very similar to sitting with gaining mind. Gaining mind is so gross that you can't see the fruits of practice if it doesn't fall away gradually as you practice. It's like trying to pick up a dime with a baseball mitt. It's just too gross to get it. It can't see it. And the same with expectations for social action. You don't know. In fact, it's hubris to think you know the result of your action. So, it's good to come to know what precisely what increases your energy level, what thoughts increase them, what thoughts decrease them, what kind of social interactions increase your energy level, what kind of social actions decrease your energy level. And to turn always toward the perception, the thought that increases, unless you want to do a little experiment. I always think it's good to experiment. Shadow thought. What would happen if I totally indulged this? If I watch TV for 10 hours a day? I think you should be prepared to find this out. Then you really will know why you don't do it, or why you might want to continue it for another month or so. To always be ready to know what happens. So it may decrease your energy level to watch TV for 10 hours, but it will increase your energy level overall to know what happens when you do that. Don't take it on faith. It's terribly difficult for us to perceive the kind of subtlety and texture that I'm talking about in our culture because it's so noisy, it's so speedy. And not that this is a bad thing. I mean, I don't know whether it's good or bad that it's noisy or speedy. I know it's irritating, but I don't know whether, you know, that's part of a new paradigm or to drive people deeper into their innards to find relief, maybe that's a good thing. So I don't know whether that's good and bad, but I know it's very difficult to enter the still mind, to live a life based on the still mind, unless you're already, I mean in your everyday life, unless you're already attuned to it from Zazen. So it's hard to stay in touch with the state of mind that uncovers the tremendous drama of life that's always just under our noses. This appreciation for texture, for suchness, whatever you want to call it, I believe that this is perceived by the body and deeply nourishing to the mind. I don't think that this kind of thing can be taught. I think that it can only be realized and recognized by the still mind. So your teacher can't tell you how to have this kind of perception. It's already within your ability, already within your faculty. So it's more a process of discovery and recognition. And this process of discovery and recognition is often driven by despair. This is what I mean about despair sometimes being creative. It drives you in further if things aren't working for you. If it looks like corporate America or global corporate, the world has such a tight fist on everything, economic, environmental, social realms, that there's no way to get in, to change it, to do anything. If that engenders despair, then this kind of inner working or inner probing is often what happens when we speak. The seeds of creativity and compassion are very often driven by despair. The despair is fertile. It opens us to actions that we might not have considered ourselves. So the heart is the locus of Zen training. It's not about information. It's not about knowledge. It's not about believing. To transmit the spirit to the heart, you must be body to body with each other. To find your support and your accountability to each other, right here. So this is the realm of infinite texture that I'm talking about. Being able to perceive other bodies that are digesting, breathing, just like you. That's so comforting. So please change the world from despair. Let your despair and your heartbeat rate be the creative force that's imagining a new world, even now. Thank you very much.